Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's edition of Radio EduTalk. I'm delighted to be joined by Alan Hardy, who's Principal of Whitburn Church of England Academy in the north of England. And tonight we're just going to be finding out a bit about what it's like to run an academy, or the nature of academies in England, and also starting to think a bit about how the academy and other in England compared to current developments in Scotland. It will be of interest to you. No doubt you'll want to get in touch. You might have questions or comments for Alan. This is actually a pre-recorded show, so recorded well in advance of the broadcast date. Comments or questions for Alan, then if you just email them to edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk. Or if you're on Twitter, you can use the hashtag EduTalk, and the audio is, of course, archived at edutalk.cc, and there's a comment function on that website. So, Alan, welcome to Radio EduTalk, and coming towards, no doubt, the end of another busy week. Could you maybe just start by giving us a bit of a background to your career in education, and also the nature of your work in your present school?
Certainly, thanks for the invitation to join you this evening, and I'm delighted to be able to have the opportunity to tell you something from my experience of what it's like to run an academy. I would love to say that it was always my aspiration to become a teacher, but I'm afraid I'm one of those people that kind of just drifted into teaching. And I can remember when I completed my geography degree at Edinburgh University, having a careers interview and actually giving the answer when asked what my career aspirations were, saying anything but teaching. So really, I suppose my interest in teaching took off when I did a master's degree at Durham University, and I was asked to work with some local schools. I would do a master's degree in ecology, and at that time the green agenda was starting to gain prominence, and I went in and spoke to a couple of local secondary schools about why I felt it was important to take ecology more seriously at that time. And that kind of, I suppose, planted a seed in my mind that actually teaching maybe not so bad after all, and it might be something I was interested in. And when I completed my ecology degree after a short spell working in retail, which I knew within a matter of days wasn't really my career, I actually went to work for the Field Studies Council in a field centre in Snowdonia, North Wales, and I started my teaching career there, working with groups of A-level geography students who came in for a week to do the fieldwork component of the course. And that kind of morphed into me working with all sorts of different groups, from primary school children to adults who were interested in the environment, contributing to things like postgraduate management course at Bangor University. And I really, really enjoyed that work. It was very intense but very rewarding. And then I learned an awful lot about geography in terms of putting what I learned in my lectures at university into practice in the field. And that really helped me decide I wanted to be a teacher. And most of all, what I felt I wanted to get out of teaching was when I worked with young people for a week or so, I then had to say goodbye to them at the end of the week. And I wanted that continuity of working with younger people over a longer period of time and seeing how they developed. And that motivated me to then apply for PGCE course, which I completed at Newcastle University. So that really was my entry into teaching.
And many listeners to EduTalk will be based in Scotland, although that we have many listeners from further afield. So no doubt you'll be very interested to hear about your current and the wider context of what we actually mean by an academy school. Could you enlighten us a little?
Well, an academy school, I guess the roots of academy school in England go back to the late 1980s when Conservative government at the time allowed some schools to become grant-maintained schools. And really that set in trail, I suppose, a long process of where schools gradually became autonomous from the local authority. And I know Mr. Gove sees academies as state-sponsored independent schools. And really, I suppose the best way to think of an academy is a school that manages to get along without the local authority support. And we have devolved to the school a number of the functions that a local authority would normally be responsible for. And effectively, we're on our own in terms of choosing who we work with and choosing what support's available. For us, it wasn't as much of a change as it is for maintained schools in England, because we were already a voluntary aided school. So already, for example, we had the ability to choose our own service level agreements outside the local authority. The governors were the employers rather than the local authority. So it wasn't as much of a journey for us as it has been for schools which have been local authority schools all the way through. There are a number of freedoms available to academies in terms of we're able to modify the curriculum. We don't have to stick to the national curriculum. We have the power, if we wish, to change the school day, school terms. We have the power to change teachers' pay and conditions. We've actually chosen not to take most of those freedoms because we're very strongly in support of the national pay and conditions in England. And we're horrified by the proposals that have been mooted to move to a regional pay structure, for example. So we're very protective of the terms and conditions of all of our staff. And in terms of changing the school day and term dates, really to keep most of our parents on board, we haven't gone down that line because we try and keep in step with neighbouring schools and particularly with a few of the primary schools.
Yeah, just to pick up on a couple of things you said there, Alan, you mentioned about the prominence of the governors or the board of governors. So what's the, I suppose in terms of across the board with academies in England, what is the nature of the relationship then between the head teacher and the governors?
I suppose the simplest way I explain it is the governors are almost like a board of directors for the company, and we are in a legal sense, we are a company, we're registered with Companies House, and effectively I am a combination of chief executive and managing director, because also I sit on the governor's board. So the governors are governors in terms of education law, but they are directors in terms of companies law, and in terms of charity, they're also trustees, so they've kind of got a tripartite role, if you like. And their job is to hold me to account for the way that I run the school, but also be there to support me as well. And as we were a church school, effectively the governing body reflects the nature of the structure of the Church of England. We've got diocesan governors, we've got deanery governors, we've got parish governors, as well as the usual staff governors, teacher governors, parent governors, etc. And we meet on a regular basis. We have various subcommittees, estates and finance, people progress, as well as the term and governor meetings. And I'm very fortunate to have a very active and supporting governing body. And effectively, we've taken forward what we had before conversion to an academy and built upon that and extended that. And from my perspective, the relationship works very, very well. I feel that I've got people on the governing body who can ask me the tough questions that need to be asked, because you can come along very, very enthusiastically with a new proposal or plan, and it needs that scrutiny and those questions asked. But equally, when I've suggested we do things that are a little bit out there in terms of other schools aren't doing this, other schools aren't doing that, the governors have been very supportive in allowing me enough rein to try out ideas. Sometimes they work very effectively, sometimes they don't, but you learn from trying different things.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier, Alan, that you're allowed to not stick to or deviate from the national curriculum in England and Wales. So is that something that you've taken advantage of, and what if you have, what kind of benefits do you see that have accrued?
I think for us, we were always, I suppose, the kind of maverick school that didn't stick necessarily fully to all the structures that we should have as a state school. And in effect, it's licensed what we do already, to keep innovating with the curriculum. We have a relatively traditional curriculum, but we deliver it in a very up-to-date way. And really that's given us license to do a few things differently in terms of changing the option system we have, in terms of looking at some of the units, the very prescriptive units in the national curriculum, and thinking, well, actually, they're not really appropriate to the needs of our children. Let's rewrite our own units for this area of work, for example.
And I'm wondering if local considerations come into play there in terms of how you develop the curriculum, and also in terms of, is that one of the reasons why you haven't changed the school year, the fact that because of local pressures or local traditions?
Yeah, I guess that is one of the reasons why we haven't. We have a lot of great resources on our doorstep, which we build into the curriculum, and it was great last week, for example, to take all of our Year 8 pupils out to Nissan and do some really active learning in Nissan, look at the whole production side, and that will feed into to lessons in science, technology, maths, etc. And we can build a number of lessons around that one-day trip experience. With the national curriculum, there isn't the same opportunity to develop that sort of aspect of learning.
Just a reminder to listeners that you're listening to Alan Harvey, who's the principal of Whitburn Church of England Academy. Alan, I'm wondering, the listeners to the programme so far will sense that you've got a mixed accent there, and there's definitely a little bit of Scots in there. So you've never really touched on it earlier on much, but my understanding is you've seen both sides of the border in terms of education systems, and I know that you've spoken in the past about that. How would you, it's a very kind of rough question, and don't expect you to talk at length necessarily, but how would you compare the kind of local system of education that you're working in with, say, one in a typical local authority in Scotland? And I suppose a second question there would be, do you think the academy system could work in Scotland?
I was invited to speak at a conference, Holyrood conference, last autumn, and actually it was very interesting meeting with colleague head teachers from Scotland and talking about some of the differences in the role. But I think it's broader than that. I think within England it's also almost a generational thing. I'm one of five recent appointments within my local authority of head teachers, and we're all a similar age, similar background, and we're all coming with completely different expectations of the role of school leadership to perhaps people that are maybe in the late 50s now and had a different experience. And I think for people of my generation in England, who have trained in England and been involved, I think the expectations of the role of a senior leader in the school are much greater. And I think one of the key things to that is the expectation that we'll have a lot more autonomy than perhaps people had in the past. And it was really interesting talking to Scottish colleagues about the appointment of staff, for instance. And I wasn't really fully aware that it seems to be in Scotland, or certainly the people I spoke to, a local authority decision as to to teacher join the school and the level of staffing. Whereas for me, that's my decision taken to the government body, and I would be horrified at the thought that I was appointing a teacher that I hadn't personally interviewed and I hadn't observed teach a lesson during the interview process, because I need to know from my perspective they'll fit into my team and be able to contribute as effectively as possible. So that's possibly one insight into the potential differences between the role in Scotland and England. Whether there's the appetite in Scotland to take that on, because I think you do need a very different view as a head teacher when you are involved much more so in things like personnel matters than perhaps when you focus almost solely on the pupils.
Was there anything else that struck you then when you took part in the conference in Scotland? In terms of the way that head teachers operate compared to those in your area?
I think from my perspective, head teachers in England have to be more directly involved in a greater range of things that aren't necessarily directly related to teaching and learning, though ultimately they are, and things that, matter what we have to do in managing the budget, and certainly as an academy, because we're subject to a whole different set of regulations than maintained schools were in the past, even the things like understanding the implications of different types of PAT and how to reclaim that money, having to, I suppose, look at the school much more in terms of being a business and revenue generation. So at the moment, for example, we've been holding an interview this week to with a company to basically out of normal school hours to someone who's going to work a social enterprise model and try and use the building more as a resource, which is great from our point of view because we want the community to come into the building as much as possible. But also, we've got a fantastic building here, which is very, very underutilized, particularly during weekends and holidays. And I'd like to, you know, to use the building more and use some of the revenue we generate from that to improve the building in future, but also to be able to do things for the pupils that I can't do under the current budget, for example.
I'm not a school leader, Alan, but I'm just wondering, as speaking from ignorance, I suppose, that one of the reasons why people in Scotland might be not keen to go down the academy would be maybe a suspicion or a perception that people who are not teaching heads or are not even qualified teachers may end up in prominent roles leading an academy or even a cluster of schools. Is that the way it's panned out in England?
I think in some context it has. I mean, that thought horrifies me because although my title is principal, I still prefer to be thought of as a head teacher, and I think that role is absolutely crucial. You have to be the lead teacher, and I'm really I struggle to understand on one level why some heads choose not to be in the classroom anymore. I can understand the pressures of the job drag you away on many levels, but one thing I've fought very strongly to maintain is that credibility as a teacher. I have a small but significant teaching load in terms of the fact that those children really matter to me and the results are absolutely crucial, and it's, you know, the first thing in my head every day is the lesson that I'm going to deliver with the children and the outcomes from that lesson, whether I can motivate them in my case to take GCSE geography. That part of the job is absolutely essential, and I would struggle to understand how somebody who hasn't got that teaching background could come in and be an effective head teacher, because I think you've got to have that perspective. What I think we've got to get better at, perhaps, as a profession, is developing the skills and people who've got leadership qualities to allow them to balance the teaching load, but also take on the leadership and management role as well.
Yeah, my next question was about distributed or distributive leadership. Is that something that is a feature of academies, or is that something that's very much part of your approach as a school leader?
I think it has to be. For any organisation to be effective, you've got to look to achieve distributed leadership. And for me, sitting in my office at the moment, the distributed leadership for me is feeling that any member of staff or indeed any pupil can knock on my door and come and talk to me about an idea or something they're concerned about. And I think if you, as a school, you're very top down, then you miss out on the potential, enormous potential that particularly your middle leaders have in taking that school forward. And you do get situations where you get absolutely outstanding heads that can drag schools forward on their own, but I think you can only get so far on that route. And for the sustainability of excellence, you have to think about not only your current generation of middle leaders, but how you're going to turn your next generation of outstanding teachers into middle leaders and so on, and then empower your middle leaders to go on to apply for senior leadership positions and get that sustainability succession planning. But you've got to make people aware that there are opportunities. You've got to make people feel consulted when you make any major change. You've got to be prepared to admit that you get it wrong sometimes and be accountable to the staff. And to me, those processes are essential to achieving distributed leadership.
And just kind of casting your gaze across the English system at the moment, what do you feel are the big issues in terms of school leadership?
I think you talk to most head teachers and say the biggest single issue is Michael Gove. But taking my tongue out of my cheek, there are obviously major issues with the examination system. And I believe that the root of that problem is the people who are responsible for setting the examination system don't fundamentally understand the whole purpose of assessment and examinations. And this year we've had a terrible kind of mismatch between the GCSEs in English particularly. We all thought the GCSEs were a criteria-based exam, and you know, if a higher proportion of children than expected met the criteria, they should be given the grades appropriately. But there seems to be some marrying of that and the old O-level approach, which was based on a bell curve and you know, always condemned some people to failure. So I think until we actually understand and have agreement as to what the examination system is supposed to measure, then we're always going to be struggling. In terms of other bigger issues, there's a big issue with funding at the moment as well, and the fact that under the move to national funding, which we're having across England over the next 2 or 3 years, there will be a movement of funding from secondary to primary schools. And as a secondary head, we have to obviously have to plan for that. And there are a number of good things going on in England and a number of very positive changes. And one thing I will applaud Michael Gove for is the focus he's put on children from disadvantaged backgrounds and not accepting excuses for their failure and lack of success. And I think this idea of narrowing the gaps, I like the idea that's probably come from the Liberal Democrats, the People Premium, just to give listeners an example of that. We have a relatively low proportion of children on free school meals, but we have quite a high proportion of children who've claimed free school meals in the past. And as a consequence, this financial year, the people premium will be worth £95,000 of additional funding, which should be targeted on those pupils.
Mm-hmm. Again, looking back to Scotland, is there anything that you're seeing going on? Although it's quite a small country, and I'm not sure how aware you'll be of things that are going on in Scotland, such as the National Partnership Group, the work that they've done into career-long professional learning, as well as the early phase of a teacher's career and management training for the future. We've also got this system of professional update on the horizon that the General Teaching Council will be running, where teachers will be likely to have to kind of evidence that they have been engaging in CPD in maybe a 5-year cycle. We've also got the new professional standards coming out, and many. I know you speak with David Cameron, and he's been involved in kind of reporting to all school management. So is there anything that stands out for you in terms of what's going on in Scotland? I suppose some ideas that might actually be replicable in Gove's England.
I think in Scotland you've got a lot of things right with the education system. We have obviously kept an eye, being relatively close to the border, on what's happening. We have with David Cameron and also with Brian Boyd, who have both contributed not only to continuing professional development events we have within school, but I've also brought them both into work with other head teachers in the local authorities around the area. I must say I like the premise of the curriculum for excellence. I think it's a million miles away from what I see as a retrograde move initiated by Michael Gove back to a very, very old-fashioned narrow curriculum. And it does concern me about the lack of emphasis on things like creativity. It's ironic, as a church school, just last year we celebrated the 200th anniversary of the establishment of church schools in England and Wales. And I guess if you look at Mr. Gove's plans for the baccalaureate and the original curriculum for those church schools 200 years ago, you wouldn't see a huge amount of difference. And with the proposals for the English baccalaureate, you probably wouldn't see a huge amount of difference in terms of how examinations are conducted. So I think in the Scottish system, I think you've gone probably further than we have in England in terms of raising the professional status of teachers. And I think teachers probably, if I'm being absolutely honest, have probably always had a higher professional standing in Scotland than they have in England. And I think there's a lot of lessons we can learn in that more strategic approach towards CPD. Although there is some good work going on in England, I think the National College, although it's been much maligned by some, the National College of School Leadership, have had a very positive impact in creating a better structure for continued professional development at various levels of teachers' careers, because we must move away from the idea that once you can as a newly qualified teacher, you're kind of on your own. And we've done a lot of work internally in developing systems and entitlements to training, which we'll continue to do so that people can make that step up the ladder in a supported way, rather than kind of accidentally, I suppose, happened to me, really.
Alan, we're just coming to the last 5 minutes of tonight's show. The aforementioned David Cameron had mentioned to me that you have a very striking and beautiful skill. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how important you feel the school campus is to the success of young people and to their learning?
Really, I couldn't have a more beautiful building, and I doubt there are many schools in the land with a more coastal location. We're literally probably 50 metres from the clifftops on site between South Shields and Sunderland. We've got an amazing building, which is not Building Schools for the Future. It's not PFI either. It was funded largely by the Department for Education in Durham Diocese. And it, compared to the building, the much loved building we had before, which is largely 1930s, far too small and not really given us enough space to do things like practicals and science, that type of thing. For the children to come into this airy, beautifully constructed building, which has got state-of-the-art ICT facilities, classrooms of a more than adequate size. We've got a balcony overlooking the sea for the art and geography students to do some work on. It's just a fabulous resource, and I think the states and the nation's schools says an awful lot about not only to the young people themselves, but also to anyone that looks at from the outside about how much value we place in the education of young people. And I think whatever the last Labour government's remembered for, I believe they should be applauded for the immense amount of work they did in addressing years of neglect in the state of schools in England and Wales and bringing them up to date. They've done a fantastic job. All of the secondaries in South Tyneside, for example, have all been rebuilt or refurbished, and we're very fortunate. I know some other areas haven't been quite so fortunate with the cuts to the Building Schools for the Future programme, for example. And education for me is just so integral to the future success of a country. How it was allowed to become so neglected for such a long period by successive governments is, you know, it just begs the question as to what could we have done better in all that time, and had we invested more appropriately in education?
David had mentioned to me that, in his opinion, the school building that you're in now couldn't be built under the current school refurbishment or school building programme within England. Is that true? Do you share that belief?
I believe it certainly wouldn't look like it does now. We had to fight a lot for the building to be the way we wanted it, and for a more traditional layout that we have. And there was a lot of talk from the Department of Education that we had to have breakout areas, for example. They wanted the corridors to be much narrower than they were. They wanted the stairs to be much narrower. We've fought for that so that our students can move around the building more easily, so that they have access to lockers, so they're safe on the stairs. So we fought a lot of battles, but I believe, you know, from talking to colleagues who are looking at rebuilds now, a lot of corners have been cut in terms of the funding, and it would be very, very difficult for any school to achieve a building as beautiful and as fully functional as we have at the moment, which is, for me, a very, very sad thing when I bring people around the building and show them and say, this, you know, this is what a school to me should be like. And I doubt there'll be many others like it in the future.
Just finally, when we have guests on the show, I'd like to invite them to maybe pose a few conundrums or reflective questions for listeners to consider. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, the obvious question really was going to be, do Scottish schools have the desire or the capacity to move towards the more autonomous model taken by academies in England? Is that something on the agenda? In terms of broader questions of leadership, I would pose the question, what further changes might we expect to see in educational leadership over the next 10 or 20 years? And the final question is, someone who's very, very passionate about the education of all young people, given my background, I won't bore you with the details, but I was the first in my family to, you know, to stay on for 6 years. I was the first in my family to go to university. And my wife's someone who came from a single parent family living in the council house in East Durham. We went to Oxford University, so we're both very passionate about creating opportunities for young people. And I would like to pose the question, what do we wish the purpose of education to be for young people, and how close are we to actually achieving this?
Thank you so much for those questions, and hopefully, whether that's through the EduTalk hashtag or through email or leaving a comment on the website when the audio goes up, hopefully we'll get some replies and some discussion. Alan, I'd like to thank you so much for taking time out this evening to provide such an excellent insight for EduTalk listeners, and best wishes for the future.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to take part. And if anyone is interested in finding more about Whitburn, I'm always very happy to take a phone call. And indeed, I'm very happy to, you know, to host anyone that wants to come down and have a look at how we operate. I'd be delighted to do that.
Thank you very much, Alan.